It is Saturday, October 27th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP 88.9. Today on Geek Speak, geek news and your calls and questions about technology.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twit.
Welcome to Geek Speak. Bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on GeekSpeak, we'll take your calls throughout the entire show. Our phone number is 1-800-655-5877. My name's Lyle Troxell. I'm a programmer and artist supporter. I work at UCSC in the Digital Arts New Media program. Master's of Fine Arts program, and photographer and father and all that jazz as well. And with me in the air room is Ben Jaffe, a web instructor and world traveler. Hi, Ben.
Yeah, and musician these days.
Are you playing a lot of music?
I've been playing more and more music, yeah.
It's fantastic.
And feeling more inspired lately. You know?
Which of your many instruments that you're efficient at are you playing lately?
I've been playing a lot of piano.
Efficient? Is that, that's not right.
Proficient.
There you go.
Proficient. That's what you're looking for. Yeah, I've been playing a lot of piano these days. The problem is I don't actually have a piano. I have a keyboard. And so I have to plug it into a computer and then plug the computer into speakers. So
how very digital of you.
I can't just pick it up and play it. So I've been playing a lot more guitar lately.
Mm-hmm.
Love guitar.
Are you playing with other people?
Not too much, actually. No. Usually just...
Why don't you whip up a little ditty for GeekSpeak? I keep using this old theme, and you know, it's that whole copyright issue. The reason why we don't play that theme all the time is because, of course, we don't own a copyright on it, but somebody does, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I like to make this show Creative Commons whenever I can because I feel like I agree with Cory Doctorow, and I think he's actually quoting somebody else, the biggest threat to creativity is not piracy, but obscurity. I'm paraphrasing, but you've heard the idea that it's not that people won't, you know, anyway, we don't make money on the show anyway. Like, I'd like more people to hear the show, so I want to make Creative Commons. Other people can do anything they want with it, put on a CD, whatever. And in fact, the Creative Commons license that we use here for GeekSpeak is, I think you just have to give us reference. I think
is
that's it.
Share alike?
I don't reference it. I'm okay with people going commercial on GeekSpeak. I mean, they can take it and start reselling it as far as I'm concerned.
Selling it.
Selling it, right. We don't sell it anyway.
We're not making money.
I mean, the only issue would be having to do with the content that we do provide, right? So, for example, the theme song that we play by Devo, that is not, of course, ours to give away by any means. So I'm always looking for a theme song. As you are looking for headphones, you're constantly switching your headphones out today. Something wrong with your ears? Sir?
Yeah. Okay. So,
but in any case, you make a theme song with just a guitar. I would love it. We don't have to have a digital theme. Just some music that sounds good.
Yeah.
Maybe live good. Next week.
Yeah. I put on my set of headphones just before the show, which I should do it. You know, maybe 3 minutes before. But I put it on right as you started talking, and I realized, oh my gosh, I can only hear you out of one ear. So then I tried the other pair of headphones that's sitting on the desk, and sure enough, I can only hear you out of the other ear. And so I, you know, pull out my headphones and here I am.
We are taking calls about questions about technology all day. We also take theme songs. If you'd like to email us a theme song, we'd love to play it. It's fun.
Wait, we're doing the show all day?
We're doing the show all day.
Just for the next hour.
All hour.
For the next 50 minutes left.
Exactly. So yeah. The phone number to call in with questions and comments about technology is toll-free and throughout the United States and Canada. And it's 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. You're a world traveler. People can't call that number outside the United States or outside of North America. I don't know what the boundary is. If you're listening in an area that seems to be questionable, do call in and tell us. No, we can call you. It's awesome. 1-800-655-5877. Of course, we do have a lot of news as well.
Yes, and yes, indeed.
So,
go ahead and call us and then let us know how big your phone bill is.
No, the problem is it's KUSP's phone bill.
Oh,
so call
right.
us later next month. We'll say, oh, we got too many calls. Please donate.
Mm.
No, of course, we love to hear from you, and I like hearing from people far away. And with our stream, assuming that you're listening via stream, you could be anywhere on the planet. As long as it wasn't yesterday that you were listening to KUSP, because yesterday there was this massive internet problem. And I didn't know anything about it because I'm sitting at a conference chatting with people in real, like, face-to-face.
I was asleep.
You were asleep when it happened. Late last night, I love some of the...
Last night. Yeah, well, yesterday morning. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yesterday morning, not this morning.
Ah, yeah, yeah. So, 7 a.m. yesterday morning. So
29 hours ago.
Yeah,
we'll say.
I think I was traveling at the time. But in any case, I love some of the headlines. The internet is falling, you know, the little bird.
The sky is falling.
For some reason, and there's no, I can't find any updates so far. Even the podcasts and the blogs that I follow and the places I read, can't find an update. It's probably on Reddit if I looked around because, of course, everything goes out to Reddit and gets high. But basically, North American internet traffic just went to a crawl. 25% packet loss, up to 33% packet loss on
That's
a lot
really
of sites
bad.
Inaccessible. And only lasted a little while, but it was interesting.
Yeah, it was like 4, 5, 6 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, some Google app engine.
Yeah, Google app engine
down.
Went down,
Tumblr,
which actually hosts a lot of things. And Tumblr, of course, hosts a lot of content. It's when these large service providers get damaged, you think, oh, it's them. And then you find out it's the network.
Yeah.
But the thing that's fascinating about it is the way they talk, the way people are talking about it is, you know, it was tagged as a disaster. You know, it's kind of in that space of, is it like a natural disaster in the sense that something happened? No one probably lost their life because the internet was down.
Yeah.
Right now. But eventually that might happen.
That's true. Yeah, it was actually just generally a bad week for the internet because who was it? Amazon. Amazon's services went down.
Right.
And a lot of websites, even big websites.
And I feel like that's the second
websites.
Time in like 2 years that's happened that Amazon services have gone down.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not bulletproof. They design well, but... But technology is complicated.
100% uptime is pretty much impossible.
Hey, let's go and do some geek news. Can you tell us about space today?
I can tell you. Well, I'll tell you about another planet, that is. So last week, you guys, I'm happy you covered the story about finding the Earth-like exoplanet and all of that. That's
well, you know,
so
I felt a little weird talking about planets, especially exoplanets without you, because you love saying that word. It's like one of your favorite words, right?
So exoplanet, yeah. So I'm not sure what amount of detail you went into it, but I just thought it was such a cool story, you know.
Also, basically, the closest star to us has an Earth-like planet.
The closest star system to us.
Closest
it's a binary
system.
Star system.
Yeah, with a red dwarf.
Star.
Yeah, we cover that. Okay,
it's
anyway,
ridiculous.
Listen
anyway,
to next week's show if you'd like, but to hear more about that story, but more closer to home.
Yeah, last week's show was good, but I haven't listened, but closer to home, the planet Uranus. So everyone sees Uranus as this kind of somewhat featureless gas giant, very blue featureless gas giant. Well, it turns out it's not actually nearly as featureless as we thought. So we've got a lot of good pictures from the Voyager probe that we got that sent out many, 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 many years ago.
Yes, we got close-up shots.
Tens of years ago.
Kind of like palish, whitish blue.
Yeah.
Totally void of any features.
Really kind of awesome, but also very boring at the same time. Same with Hubble. The Hubble Space Telescope has been looking at it. Voyager wasn't able to see a lot of detail because, and same with Neptune, because it couldn't see infrared. And it turns out that in the non-infrared, if you're not looking in the infrared, you don't see a lot of the detail. But if you can look down in the infrared, you can see a lot of detail that you can't see because of the methane in the atmosphere that blocks all of the detail. So anyway, I just want to briefly say, and this could be a geek bit, but I'm going to talk about how we did this imaging too. Some pretty cool photos. It kind of looks like Jupiter, actually. Except
down
it's not.
Below that higher cloud level.
Yeah, because Jupiter, you look at Jupiter, you see all of this detail, you know, all of the clouds and the swirling
storms,
gas and everything. Yeah. But to me, the most impressive thing is how we got this imagery. So typically when we're taking pictures like this, we take maybe 50 of these pictures all in a row, you know. Any photographer knows, you know, don't just snap one shot, snap 10 shots and then choose the best one.
So
right?
In case Neptune's blinking. Is
in
that
case
why?
Neptune is blinking. Right. No, well, you can actually take these and layer them on top of each other, and then you see the detail and all of the noise gets canceled out, right?
You're kind of describing the process of creating an HDR image, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very, very similar, except not changing exposure, really. So you basically just average these together. The problem is that that Uranus is a moving target. It's actually spinning. And not only is it spinning, also the gases are moving. So how do you deal with that, right? If you take 50 pictures...
So it's like when you've got a 7-year-old spinning in the room dancing late at night at a party. If you take a picture, it's just kind of blurry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Or if you take lots of pictures, lots of blurry pictures don't give you a good...
Exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Or if you take many pictures in a row, they're all going to be from a slightly different angle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what do you do? So what they actually did was they took all of these and they mapped them out. Basically, they took... if you look at a picture of the Earth as a globe, and then you look at a picture of a map where it's all flattened out, that's what they did, is they took these images and they flattened them out, and then they
and
aligned
matched
them
up. Oh, right. That makes sense. But what about the storm effects?
In addition to that, there are all these storm effects. And actually, it's kind of crazy. If you look at the equator, everything is shifting to the left because the winds are moving to the left. About 25 degrees north and about 25 degrees south, it's not moving relative to the planet. With rotation accounted for. But if you go further north, everything's moving to the right.
Okay,
or further
awesome.
South, everything's
sure.
So it's not
so that has to do with the Coriolis effect,
crazy.
Right? That has to do with when you move fluids over a sphere that's rotating, those fluids actually change their velocity based on the surface getting, the equator's larger, right? So as they move, as northern winds move south, they have to speed up, if you will, because they're traveling over more Earth. So those effects,
Precisely. That's
what we call the Coriolis effect, that the effect, the Coriolis effect is producing those kind of turbulence. And that's why, for example, you'll see that storm systems in North America spin a certain way. Like that's one of the reasons.
Absolutely.
And so in this situation, you see that from a distance, since it's a whole gassy planet, the planet's also rotating compared to us.
Mm-hmm.
So its gases, though, relative to its surface, as they move, have different speeds relative to us. So you get this kind of tri-band rotational thing. That's really cool.
It's insane.
All right, so this,
yeah.
this sounds like a geek bit because you got to go see this image, right?
It's so cool, but I love how we can take pictures of things that are so far away and infer just based on wavelengths, based on movement, based on parallax, based on all these different things that we as humans don't have any direct experience really using. A little bit with parallax, but not really.
Right.
We can infer all of this crazy stuff and figure out what's actually out there.
Yeah, very cool.
It's kind of amazing.
Uranus is the seventh planet from the sun. Uranus is the seventh planet from the sun. It's the third largest planetary radius and fourth largest planetary mass in the solar system. It's named after the ancient Greek deity of the sky.
Uranus.
That's right. the father of Cronus or Saturn. That's the other name for him. The grandfather of Zeus or / Jupiter. And though it is visible to the naked eye, like the classical planet, the five planets, the classical planets were the ones we could actually see with the naked eye. It was never recognized as a planet by ancient observers because of its low orbit and size. And it was finally announced as discovered, if you will, March 13th, 1781 by William Herschel. And it was the first planet that was detected or discovered by a telescope because the other planets were actually already inferred that they were planets. So that's kind of a cool thing.
Look at where 300 years gets us, right?
It is a gas giant in that sense. Pretty cool. I'm glad to hear that it's getting more recognition.
Very, very cool. Yeah. it's also the butt of all the jokes, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Just because of the pronunciation issues.
Absolutely. That was a low blow, man.
Let's, hey, I'm just acknowledging the problem.
We're going to do a little bit something a little different today. We're taking calls throughout the show.
Ooh.
And so we'll go ahead and take a call right now, if you don't mind, Ben.
I certainly don't.
All right, great. Well, let's go ahead and go to Aptos Elizabeth. Welcome to GeekSpeak. Or are we not going to take a call? Maybe Elizabeth went away for a moment. I guess taking calls in the first half of the show is completely different than taking calls in the second half. Let's do the next news story, sir.
It's kind of interesting, yeah.
Go for it.
All right, so I want to talk about wireless network speed. So typically if we talk about boosting...
You know what? Let's talk about wireless network speed in just a second because you know what?
Do we,
Elizabeth
do we
is online. Yeah, hi, Elizabeth. Elizabeth, can you say hello to us, please? I'm teasing you.
Oh.
Go ahead and start talking again. I'll interrupt you.
All right. Sounds good. So, yeah, usually when we talk about increasing wireless performance, we're talking about boosting the power or something like that, or adding more base stations or using more of the wireless spectrum, right?
Right.
But there's actually a way to boost the performance of wireless networks that we currently have using just software. And it turns out it all has to do with algebra. So, basically what you do is instead of sending packets, you send equations that describe packets. Just simple, linear, algebraic equations.
Okay.
And then if a packet is dropped, then the other end, the end that you're sending the packet to, so a server sends a packet to your computer. Your packet or your computer gets, let's say, 5 out of the 6 packets or 7 out of the 8 packets. One of them is missing. Normally, what it would have to do is it'd have to say, hey, server, send packet number 7 again, please,
right.
because I got lost. Instead, your computer can actually take the information that was sent and figure out what the packet would have been. So there's a little bit more redundancy just using linear equations.
Okay.
It's kind of
cool.
So
this would be a complete modification to the TCPI stack.
Yes. It's not something you could just...
It's research-based.
Like, oh, I'll just go ahead and install it right now. No, it's not quite there.
Additionally, we have a lot of waste on how network traffic flows. I mean, the way you and I would communicate through TCPIP connections would be that I would send a whole bunch of packets, and every once in a while you would tell me what the last one was, and then I would... I would send from there on, right? Even if you received packets after that number, the last one that was sequentially received mm-hmm. by you is the one you tell me you're done with or you got.
Yeah.
So if I send you packets 1 through 2,000, but I missed number 42, you'll say, hey, start sending me from 42, mm-hmm. right? So there's a lot of waste right there. So yeah. I could see that it could be, and of course, our level of simplicity at that low level is really important because we want speed. We don't want it. But processing power increases and routing processor power increases. So you could put more smarts in the routing and make the protocol more complicated. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but it's an interesting theoretical thing.
But using this, so using your example, I mean, 42, right? That means you have to send all those packets all over again, almost all of them all over again. Nice number choice, by the way, 42. But... In testing this, so if it, of course it's not ready for being rolled out or anything like that, not by any means. But in testing, they actually found that campus Wi-Fi on MIT's campus jumped from 1 megabit per second to 16. So this is like an order of magnitude. They tested it on a fast-moving train. They were getting 5% packet loss. They got a connection speed jump from half a megabit per second to 13.5 megabits
Ooh,
per
second. Exciting.
That's well over an order of magnitude.
Yeah. So you could see someone doing a new protocol for some new communication methods, right? Mm-hmm. So you have a phone system maybe taking on this responsibility.
Maybe.
Somewhere where both sides are kind of controlled by somebody. Yeah, interesting.
It's cool. Kind of awesome.
Fast network speeds, not going to happen soon to your house, but interesting nonetheless.
But I love the idea of using algebra.
Of course you do. I mean,
it takes us a long time to solve algebraic equations. But
computers are like, no problem.
Yeah, smartphones.
From Aptos, Elizabeth, you are now with us, and I welcome you to Geek Speak.
Hi, is it working this
it
time?
Is. Yes. It is.
Okay. I have a question actually about a camera, because I know you're a photographer, and it seems geeky enough to ask. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Well, I have an old Sony digital... Simple, cheap camera that I adore because it has Zeiss lenses.
What's it called?
And so it takes incredible photographs. I even have a photo up right now at the Cabrillo Gallery. And I just want to improve a little bit, but I don't understand cameras. I'm not geeky. I need something really, really, really simple to use in an SLR. So I'm wondering if there's either you know something or there's a place online or a
yes.
group or people that
yes.
I could ask about.
Let me first ask, what camera do you have right now?
I have a Sony, and I'm so stupid about cameras, I don't even know.
But it's got exchangeable lenses.
It's called a DSC P10. It's a smart zoom. It only has like 3...
megapixels? Yeah, it's an older camera.
It has 5 megapixels.
Okay.
And I think it has 3 zoom. Like, I want something with a little more zoom than with macro, but I still want to
know. Now, you have exchangeable lenses, right?
No.
Okay,
it's
so you want to...
Like, I want something really, really light, no exchangeable lenses.
Oh, okay.
Really cheap.
Yeah.
Use, like,
all right, so unfortunately...
Stuff.
Unfortunately, there's going to be a bit of research for you because there's so many cameras out on the market.
I know.
Luckily, there's this awesome website that I use every time I want to learn about new cameras. And every once in a while, I'll just go up there and see the latest lens from Nikon and just drool, right? By the way, the lens that I want right now from Nikon is a 24-70 millimeter, I believe, and I think it's like $1,200. And you know what? I can't afford that.
That's just the lens.
Yeah, that's just the lens. But the thing is, about lenses, lenses are kind of everything about a camera. I mean, in the SLR space, right? Once you get to the space where you don't have changeable lenses, it's not so important because it is the camera. But just to let everybody know what an SLR is, the professional photographers you see, you know, the guys that stick their cameras in people's faces and annoy them, the paparazzi, are normally using an SLR camera. That's a single lens reflex camera. What it means is that as you look through the eye hole, you're actually looking through the lens of the camera. There's a mirror in there. And when you release the shutter, that mirror moves out of the way, blocking your eyesight for a moment and making that wonderful clicking sound, and also exposing the actual receiving area to the light. So in a traditional camera that would have been film and now it's digital, they work exactly the same. So my Canon. I mean, I've got a Nikon D7000, which is an SLR in the consumer area, but it's high in the consumer area. And I love the camera. It does do a clicking thing. It also allows, because it's a newer type of technology, it allows you to open that shutter all the time and use the display on the back as a lifetime preview, which you have to do when you are doing something like taking video. And then if you actually do a snapshot, the shutter goes down and comes back up and goes down again. It does this kind of clicky thing, which is strange. In any case, I use it as a video camera all the time, and I love that. Now, the lens that I use for it most of the time is a portrait lens. It's a static 60mm lens, which gives you a very close-up, beautiful, equivalent to an 80mm lens. Anyway, great portrait shot. I love taking portraits. But when you're in a group shot, it's horrible because you have to stand so far back that you get hit by cars. So I have a secondary lens. And it is true that when you have multiple lenses, you just never switch them, right? Because I've got my camera, and if I have to carry my whole bag, and then the other lens is totally, yeah. Anyway, so you don't end up switching it. So instead, what most consumers want is a lens that does a zoom. And it's very important to do a zoom with optical, an optical zoom, meaning that you actually move the lens information, the telescope in the lens, you actually modify it to modify its behavior. If you do it digitally, of course, you're basically throwing away pixels. All right. That's the long and the short of SLR. You probably knew all of that already because you're a photographer.
I'm really an idiot. I just point and shoot. That's
yeah.
what I mean. It's like I just want something this so simple, but this takes... I think I've lucked out because I have incredible shots that I get, and people love my greeting cards and everything. I think because I have the Zeiss lens, which is automatic on a Sony, I think, and I think there's one other type of camera that has that kind of lens, but mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
Okay, so here is your next 3 hours, okay, of your beautiful Saturday. Keep Geek Speak on, but go to dpreview.com. That's digital photography, dpreview.com. I love this site, really good reviews, good synopsis. They even have a buying guide, and they're going to walk you through different steps. What I would think for you is that there's this whole new line of they're exchangeable lenses. They don't have a mirror in them to lift up, so they're not an SLR. They're called a mirrorless camera. But there's actually all point and shoots are mirrorless cameras, right? But these have a little bit better lens. They're a little larger, and the other thing about a lens that's really important, and this is kind of a generic thing you can say about cameras, is the more light that you bring into the camera by the lens, the better photograph you will have. And that's
so the ones you just mentioned.
Yeah.
I forgot to say the thing that I love about this and I hate about the new simple cameras is that this has a viewfinder.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the new ones seem like they don't. Like if I want to look at something in the light, I can't see it.
Yeah.
You know, like I take a lot of beach photos.
Yeah, but is your viewfinder using the actual lens, the prime lens?
Yes, it is.
So it is an SLR.
Okay, so that means anything that's an SLR would be that.
If you're looking through the actual lens with real optics, that means that you have to block that light. Or if you, let's say you were taking a photograph and the sun was behind you and for some reason it was hitting the eyepiece, that would actually deposit light onto the sensor. So you have to block that light. So if you're looking through the lens itself, which I think personally is the way to go.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, but now at the same time, looking at an image, a digital image on the back of the screen, a reproduced image, you're also looking at what the camera is going to take a picture of, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just that there's you're already digitizing it. You're already looking through the computer's eye. And also, as you said, in a very bright situation, that screen can't compare to the sun, and so it's very hard to see. You start ending up like kind of putting your hands around it and making like a little eye protector for you to see.
Yeah.
So if you really want that eyepiece, the actual physical optical, you look through it and then it switches to from your eye to the mm-hmm. material that receives it, you're going to want an SLR. A single lens reflex camera.
Now, the name of the site, could you say it a little more
I'll slowly? Say it again. I also mentioned that I'm going to put this up on geekspeak.org in moments from now.
Sure. Okay.
So geekspeak.org will work. It is DP, as in digital photography, review.com. Pretty simple.
Okay, and then just for fun, what was the one that you said? You have a Nikon? What kind?
I have a Nikon D7000. And that's not a full-frame sensor, so it's not extremely expensive. I think it's a little under $1,000, but then you buy lenses on top of that. So it's not a cheap camera.
Like $200.
Right, right. And I have a collection of like 200,000 photos at this point. I'm kind of a photoholic.
I have a lot, too.
200,000?
All right, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much. Good luck.
Bye.
200,000 photos?
Yeah, you know, I use Lightroom, which is Adobe's management program. And Lightroom is... this kind of database of photo management. And it happens to keep track of all my photos. I can preview all the photos I've ever taken that are in the system. And there's over 200,000 photos.
That's incredible. So I just divided 200,000 by 365. If you were to take one photo a day, that'd be 548 years of photos.
Well, keep in mind, one thing that's kind of tricky about this is that it counts every photo, and sometimes I do time lapses. And time lapses are, you know, taking a picture every 5 seconds over 2 hours, and then I make a 1 minute film out of that. So that's a lot of the count is this kind of duplicate. Mm. And of course, if I'm taking a shot, a whole bunch of photos of like Rocky Horror Picture Show, which by the way is at Park Hall tonight.
Ooh.
very awesome show, by the way, at Mockery Theater. Anyway, if I'm taking photographs of that show in one night, I'll take 500 pictures, but only six or seven of them will actually use for the press shots, right? Because just the way that you do photography, you really want to cycle out. It's one of the awesome things about digital.
So, yeah, I guess if you were to count every frame of video that you do.
No, you do more video, probably.
Yeah, that's only 1.8518 hours of video.
Can you do that in like non-algebraic communication?
1 hour and
the answer to that question minutes. Is no, Ben. I think it's what you're looking for.
Oh, and negative 58 minutes. I think I did my math wrong. Darn it. Order of operations.
Let's go ahead and take another call. Oh, no, you know, we got to do this first. I got to mention to you that you're listening to Geek Speak on Central Coast Public Radio, 88.9 KOSP.org. We're streaming and podcasting there. And of course, anything that we talk about on Geek Speak is available at geekspeak.org. I really should do that. Yeah, let's see.
Multitasking.
Well, I want to say that now the DP review thing's up on the website. So, okay.
Oh, okay.
So everything we talk about at Geeks. Geeks Beyond KOSP is supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. Information is at RamirezDDS.com. We have any geek bits today?
I do have a geek bit.
I do too.
It is firstmenonthemoon.com. It's a website which takes you through the Apollo 11 moon landing.
Nice.
And it takes you through all of the audio. You can see who's talking. It shows on the left the air-to-ground loop, on the right the flight director's loop. You can see where they're sitting in the room. You can see the video. You can see little graphics about what's going
on.
How
long
is
it, like 6 hours of audio?
No. It's just the landing.
Oh, that's so cool.
So it's all of the the approach.
I'm totally doing that side with my kids. That sounds fantastic.
So cool.
Yeah. I didn't live it the first time. You did? No, that's right. You were born last year?
I think I was born 2 years ago.
My little recommendation, 2 weeks ago, I did John Crockford's book. Douglas.
Douglas
Crockford's book.
John.
What? I know a John. I think that's why I know a John.
Oh.
Anyway.
JavaScript.
Yeah. No, I don't. Douglas Crockford's book, which I still highly recommend. And it's called
JavaScript
the Good Parts. Thanks. But I also want to recommend to you Marvin Haverbeck's book, Eloquent JavaScript. Unlike me, this book is called Eloquent JavaScript, A Modern Introduction to Programming. Now, 2 weeks ago when I made a review of Crockford's book, or last week, I don't remember what it was, I mentioned that it was really good for someone who's already been programming in another language or has been programming in JavaScript for a while. Beautiful for that. So it was great for Ben and Miles and myself. This week, and I did mention that I know of a book that's really great for non-programmers, and this one is fantastic. A Modern Introduction to Programming, Eloquent JavaScript. Anybody in the planet that has ever used a computer and reads English should pick up this book if they're interested in programming. Even if you don't want to become a programmer, it's written so nicely. It's such a good intro to what programming languages are. And though it sounds a very geeky thing, and of course I've been spending days talking about programming, but I spent a lot of my time doing that, the reason that I think it's important in our society has to do with how mediated we are by programming. So the programming languages of our world define almost everything we do, right? The stop sign that stops your car and lets other people go, there's a program there. It's a software program running, and it was probably written in C, and it's on, maybe not, maybe it's more complicated than that. Maybe it's a C++ app. But the point is that everything in your life that's not, you getting eggs from your chicken coop is mediated by a computer.
You do that too.
Oh, yeah, I do. I even have an analog timer, right? There's no computer.
Well,
click.
Ooh, you could really go into the philosophical realm and say, wait, aren't you a computer getting chicken?
No,
eggs?
But
I'm not going to do that.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, we won't do that. But but I will say that if you understand the basic idea of how computers programmed, you understand something akin to the era when there were scribes that were copying in books, and the only people that could write were these very knowledgeable people. And those people controlled what the world and society did by writing books, and then people would read them, right? And the printing press kind of liberated that, allowed that to happen a lot more quickly. But still, the printing press people, those people controlled the knowledge of our society. In this day and age, the programmer controls the knowledge of our society. The programmer is that elite. And you can step into that space and at least understand it. I highly recommend it. In any case, A Modern Introduction to Programming, Eloquent JavaScript. What do you think, Margin?
Margin?
Is that the name?
Yeah, I think M-A-R-I-J-N.
We need Miles here. He's awesome. Margin, yeah. Heverbeck. All right. And there is a bird on the cover, and it's yellow, and it's available in town.
The bird is not yellow. The cover is yellow. The bird is white.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I just have to say, I'm happy you mentioned stoplights, because some stoplights are made better than others. San Francisco, if whoever programmed the stoplights for San Francisco is listening, amazing job.
You want to have their children.
Whoever programmed the stoplights for Sunnyvale is listening,
go to hell.
Please go do it again.
We're supported by Cruzeiro Works, rentable workspace located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz, featuring 40 new private offices, meeting rooms, an organic cafe, and 100 megabits per second Wi-Fi. More information is at cruzeio.com/cruzeioworks, or just call 459-6301. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. We are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877.
I got a quick note.
Yeah.
I noticed that you hesitated. Megabits per second.
Look at the text.
Is it Mbps?
Well, the thing with text in any of these things we read, right? I've been doing it for years, but the way you make it really clear is you make it all capital. Well, that's how they do it in these logs. And actually, the reason why punctuation and upper and lowercase was added into the society was because as we started trying to figure out, it was actually a church decision, right? So as we tried to decide what the actual Bible said, we realized there was lots of copies of the Bible, because it's actually extremely hard to copy perfectly anything. And so the punctuation and lowercase were invented to try to make it easier for people to copy. In any case, that's why we have uppercase and lowercase. In any case, when they do this, we have the Cruzeiro Works, which is a really cool space downtown Santa Cruz in the old Sentinel building, by the way. They've got, it says 100 megabits per second Wi-Fi. How would you write bits?
B-I-T-S?
Right, but you do it lowercase, right? Because it's bits, it's not bytes.
M-B-P-S, you mean?
Well, but even if you spelled the whole word out, it being lowercase reference to my mind, bits, being uppercase is big, so...
Well, bytes. I was just going to mention, just for the listener, if you ever see M-B-P-S and the B is big, that's bytes. If the B is small, that's bits.
Awesome.
But even so, we talk about technology a lot, and yet we still hesitate every single time. I did three, I mentioned megabits per second three times in a couple stories ago, and it's so frustrating.
And now for something that matters in your life. Hi, in Santa Cruz, Stuart, welcome to Geek Speak. Hello, Stuart?
Hi, I am here.
Hi, welcome to Geek Speak. You're on air.
Hi, I have a common question, I think.
Okay.
My computers are like slowing down and sometimes freezing, and like I'll click on Mozilla and it'll take like a minute to open, and I'll click on it again and it'll
open. Are you running Windows?
Windows, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, there's the problem. No, how old's your computer?
It's really old.
Yeah. They're really
1521.
I'm sorry?
It's a Dell Inspiron 1521.
So pretty old.
Yeah, it's ancient.
Okay, so most likely the machine could operate the same as it used to operate, with just a little bit of repair. Normally when a computer actually has this kind of problem, it's due to a hard drive. And as strange as that sounds, hard drives are extremely complicated piece of machinery, and they're actually repairing themselves all the time and compensating for themselves. So the bits are kind of, you can imagine the data substrate and the little computer inside there as being a kind of, I imagine it as like a very complicated, dense circus, right? And you have these crazy little clowns jumping up and down trying to get attention, and those are the bits that are kind of working. And then you have this, the facade of dead cars. I mean, it's kind of this mesh of crazy. Okay, and then there's this really good application in the in a board trying to figure it all out. And it rereads things and it moves things around and it tries to organize all the time. So it's like this battle of chaos that's happening on a hard drive. And that's why, and of course, it's spinning really, really fast, you know, thousands of
7,200 RPM or whatever.
Yeah. So that's 7,200 times per second it rotates, right? That's insane. So in any case, over time, though that chip is going to keep on trying to work, it's going to be harder and harder for it to do its job of reading and writing the data. And so all you do is replace the hard drive and everything goes a lot better. But the replacing hard drive is kind of like getting dressed in a storm. You don't really want to take all your clothes off and get all wet and cold and then put your clothes back on. It's kind of a mess. You'd like to go somewhere safe and secure. And unfortunately, it never feels that way. It always feels like you're vulnerable. So what I'd recommend
I love these metaphors. This is crazy.
We should call the show Metaphor Show Day.
So a hard drive is kind of like Lyle explaining hard drives.
Exactly. So what I would recommend is taking a look at how much time you want to spend, how much money you want to spend, and whether you want to trade one for the other, right? Mm-hmm. So you can buy like a Dell Inspiron, the same machine you have right now from Overstock.com. It's a refurbished machine, which will probably be pretty good, for under $300, right? So you'd get the same thing, and it would be pretty painless, though you'd have two computers, which would be kind of annoying, right? The other thing you could do is just get the hard drive replaced. And if you're not really a geek and don't have like a secondary computer, I'd recommend taking it someplace to do that. And they'll charge you not that much, probably about under $300. The thing is frustrating. But the data will be migrated for you.
Another potential problem that you can run into, if you have an older machine, as you update to the new software, sometimes the new software, it expects you to have better hardware.
Right.
You know, so like if you were running Windows XP and then you started running Windows 7, or let's say you're trying to run Windows 8 or something like that, Windows 8 expects you to have a very high performance machine, whereas Windows XP doesn't expect that, because when XP was released, we didn't have machines that were that fast. So that might be another a potential problem. If you've updated the operating system, or if you've installed all of the different security packs and things like that, things can get a little bit bogged down.
The traditional thing I used to do in Windows XP is I would just reinstall the operating system every once in a while. That was like a standard protocol to make
the
machine
fast.
That
was my every 18 months, maybe every 12 months.
And I tend to think that more it's about hard drives. Because I remember now.
Really?
As a geek, when you install an operating system, why wouldn't you replace the hard drive, right? Because the problem with replacing a hard drive is not unplugging the two things and removing the four screws. That's easy, at least on a desktop machine. The problem with it is you've got to migrate all your data. But if you're upgrading the OS with a clean install, you're doing that anyway. So I think that every time I installed my OS, I would actually put a new hard drive in the machine. So maybe they're correlated, maybe they're not. Maybe one's only the problem. And that's a tough question.
I'm not convinced. I don't know. It could be either way.
I'm not trying to convince you. So does that help at all, Stuart?
Yeah. I have another question. What's the difference between the C drive and the D drive?
Ah, okay. So you have a dual partition machine. So
or a CD drive.
Well, he's a laptop. No, maybe. Probably not.
Wait, it's a laptop, right?
Yeah, it's a laptop. Yeah.
Is the D drive only work when you put a disk in it, or is it definitely a hard drive?
I think it's part of the hard drive.
Okay, so if you're writing data to it, if you're saving to it, it's part of the hard drive. And in that laptop, most likely it doesn't have two hard drives. So what's happening here is an abstraction level that occurs in computers. And they're called partitions. So though physically you have one hard drive in that computer, most likely, somebody at some point decided to put two partitions on that drive. So to the operating system in every single way, except for at a very low level, it looks like there are two hard drives on that computer. And there's some really great reasons to do that. I used to do that traditionally when I was in a Windows environment. And the reason is this. If you always make a practice to put all the data that you care about on the D drive, you change all your settings to save things there, you do everything you possible in that space, that's the stuff you create and you care about. And on the C drive is only your Windows installation. It's only the operating system and the applications. Then when you do decide to wipe the hard drive and not replace, wipe the operating system and reinstall the operating system and not replace the hard drive, it's very easy to do so without destroying your data. You have basically separated yourself out. Now, Microsoft does this inherently by default. They make a folder called My Documents, and everything should be inside there of yours. But sometimes you forget to move that. And
doesn't
also,
work
it's
out
not always
way.
The same. It's not always true. So that's why a secondary hard drive looking thing, a partition would work on a computer is for that purpose. It does not help from a scratch disk perspective if you're doing something with Photoshop, because the speed, there's no speed increase. In fact, there's a speed decrease when you're using multiple partitions because you have two lookup tables, basically.
You know, another possibility is that a lot of computer manufacturers will actually partition the hard drive for you. So you'll get your computer, and then you'll have two quote unquote hard drives. Even though it's actually one hard drive, it's multiple partitions. And sometimes they do that to have maybe some recovery data on another drive or something like that. And so they have their own proprietary way of restoring.
Right. Things. Sometimes there's a locked write only partition that actually you can boot from to recover your system, if you will.
So I guess there are a number of reasons it could exist. The reason that you would do it yourself would be something like Lyle was talking about.
Yeah. So if I were in your shoes, I would not buy a new laptop. I would most likely take that laptop, go buy a hard drive that would fit it. You could research that on what kind of hard drive it would be. Buy a new one. You're going to get a lot larger hard drive. At the same time, go ahead and look at how much RAM you have, how much RAM the machine can handle. Get the max of that. You're going to spend somewhere in the neighborhood of $150 on the hardware, right? The new hard drive and the RAM. And then you take apart your machine. You put that stuff in there. When you buy that hard drive, if you want to buy an enclosure, I'll get to that in a second. I already have enclosures. So I'd pull the old hard drive out. I'd put the new hard drive in, the new RAM in. I'd take my Windows disk, install Windows, except that I'd probably go with Ubuntu. But anyway, install Linux on the machine. I mean, start Windows on the machine, getting a completely new machine running. Then taking in that enclosure, which basically allows you to power up your hard drive externally,
I'd put the old hard drive in that,
mm-hmm. connect it up, and then do a data migration over. And there's actually a tool in Windows for, I think it's called Windows Recovery or something, but you can do that in. You could also do it manually if you want. And you'll have a very time-consuming but clean process. It's like spring cleaning. It takes you 2 days, but it's awesome afterwards.
Yeah, in addition, that would be basically doing both of Lyle and my suggestions.
Oh, really?
Lyle's would be replacing the hard drive. I would say reinstall the operating system.
Right. The thing about reinstalling the operating system is if it is a hard drive, you go through all that process without helping yourself.
Exactly.
Now, again, the other thing I would do, because I already have the application, there's like a $80 application or something like that from grc.com, and this is Gibson Research Center. Steve Gibson is this amazing guy that wrote this wonderful application that recovers hard drives. It saves hard drives. It looks at them and inspects them. It does all this work. Since I already have that application, I'd probably run that on the hard drive, confirming that the hard drive was bad or that I could repair it. And the machine would probably run a lot faster right off the bat. But it is like, you know, a little less than a $100 application. And if you are only trying to save this one drive, don't do it, right? And his license is pretty clear that you don't use your friends, right? This is his bread and butter. This is the only thing he actually charges for. So I would basically do my own machine. Yeah. But in any case, that's another option. There you go, Stuart. That's our recommendation.
Can I read you some numbers?
Yeah. Can I read you some numbers? No, go ahead.
There's 1.61 gigabytes free of 136 gigabytes on the C drive.
That actually might be the real problem.
That could be a serious problem right there.
1.6 gigabytes free for Windows is not a lot. Actually, for any operating system, really, is not a lot. So, one more quick explanation. So you've got your more permanent storage, and then you've got your temporary storage, kind of like short-term and long-term memory, right? Your short-term memory is RAM. And if your computer runs out of RAM, that's all the programs you're running and things like that, it will actually put some of that information onto the hard drive temporarily. It's called a swap file. And so if you don't have enough space free and available, then your computer doesn't have a lot of space for the swap file, meaning you can't run a lot at once, meaning the whole thing is sluggish. That might be the problem.
The tricky thing is the solution to that, of course, is increase your, either pull off some applications, remove a whole bunch of applications,
and then when you do
reinstall applications, install them. When you go through the process, go through the advanced install and choose your D partition. That's the simplest way to do it. You remove a whole bunch of applications, clearing up your C partition, and then when you install, you decide, put some of these applications in the D drive. It's a little weird because you're kind of stretching. It will work, though. The other thing to do is you grab an application that repartitions your drive. The problem with that is that it's always dangerous to repartition your drive. And then you could potentially just double the size of your C partition, decrease the size of your D partition. But again, a hard drive, under $50, right? I mean, they're not that expensive.
Yeah. One other option, if you want to try probably the simplest thing, which we still haven't mentioned, I don't know a Windows program to do this, but basically a program which will look for the largest files on your hard drive. And then find out if there are any big, humongo files, especially video files, that you don't need. And then you can delete those. I mean, honestly, you could probably find I would guess you could probably find 5 gigs worth of files, which is maybe 50, 100
files.
But
only on the C drive. In fact, just move
only
them
on the C drive. Yeah.
Just don't move an application from the C drive to the D drive by dragging it, because you'll have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's 9.07 megabytes free of 9.99 gigabytes.
On the
D drive?
On the D, 9.05 megabytes free.
Oh, you have a serious problem.
Yeah.
In the sense that you have too much data in your computer. You've maxed out your hard drive completely.
Yeah,
you
just need find to get stuff that you don't need.
Just do this for yourself. Every partition should have at least 20% of its total size free. If you keep in that space, you'll do better. Whenever my Mac slows down, that's what's happened. I've just uploaded way too many pictures. We already covered that I take too many pictures, right? All right, thank you, Stuart, for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Wow, that was fun. Oh, yeah, and by the way, Explorer can do the search by size. You just do search by size. You know how every time when you're in Windows and you want to do a search of a file, it says, what 17 different ways do you want me to search your computer?
Mm-hmm.
And you always only want to do by file name?
Yeah.
And it's really frustrating to click it. There's one of those in there that's actually by size. It's useful in the situation.
You know what's frustrating to me, too, is Windows, but both Windows and OS X now, when they search your hard drive, they don't search all the files on your hard drive. They just search the files that they think you should have access to. So they don't search files that are deeper down, you know, inside the library folder on a Mac, for example, or a system folder. It's kind of annoying.
Okay, so rarely do I deviate on GeekSpeak from our general topic, which is anything we want to talk about. But right, is that our definition of GeekSpeak?
Maybe.
So I'm going to go into geek. I have nothing to say that this is geeky at all, except that it's awesome.
You like it.
I love it.
A geek likes it.
All right. So a friend of mine, Lance McVeigh, who's been a longtime friend of mine, he took me camping when I was like 13, right? And I asked for a ghost story. And he said, I don't know any ghost stories. So fast forward like 25 years or something like that. And I have kids the same age, a little younger. And they now have a book that I read to them that's about ghost stories, written from my friend Lance, who to some degree decided to write this because of our naggings. Now, Lance's book, it's called Lighthouse Tales. It's on my Twitter feed. I'm trying to pimp it as much.
Lighthouse Tales?
Lighthouse Tales. See? Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah. A little tiny blue book. It's available in town. It's available all over the place. It's also available at, I think it's lighthousetales.com, which makes sense. But the point is that he's doing a reading today. I'll be at the reading. It's at Loudon Nelson in Santa Cruz. Come meet me. I'll have a blue and white shirt on, it looks like, with green stripes. Come meet me and say hi, and also listen to this book. It's a great, it's not for children. It's scary. My 7-year-old's had some trouble with it. But it's scary in the sense of drastic things happen, not necessarily suspense. And it's also in rhyme, which is fantastic.
Ooh.
So I'm going to read a little bit of the last main story called Justice for Jessica Pope to get you a feel of it. It happened in Britain, or so it was written, by the late Madam Jessica Pope, that two very dear friends would come to their inns with an axe and the end of a rope. One's name was Gerald, the other Sir Duane, and friends they had been since their birth. But now they are gone, and they shan't see a dawn from the fiery bowels of the earth. And it goes on to tell the story, as the first first stanza says, what will happen. So in any case, it's fantastic. The book's, it's not that long. I think the whole thing's under about 100 pages. Fun, and Lance is going to be reading it today. I think there's a suggested donation, but not necessary, at Loudon Nelson at 6:30 tonight.
This is like a shorter version of Dante's Inferno. Right.
Well,
all in rhyme, right?
That one story, I actually have probably the first, I don't know, 4 pages to memory, because I love the story so much. And when I read it to my family the other night, Maggie, my partner, was like flabbergasted at how good it is. I mean, it's got the rhyme, but the story itself is very cool. Anyway, I highly recommend coming and meeting me, and maybe Ben will go there.
Maybe yeah.
Not. Yeah, yeah. At Loudon Nelson tonight, 6:30, and listening to some readings from Lighthouse Tales by Lance McVeigh. All right, let's go on to our last call today. Maybe not. Maybe we'll get two in. But what line are we on? Ah, line 3. So from Ben Lohman, my hometown, Mardine, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I have to make this quick because we've only got a few minutes left. But
sure.
I'm not a tech geek, but I'm more of a graphics geek. And this ends up being a question about version updates, software version updates, especially from Apple. The latest version of Adobe Illustrator, the C6, I get a lot of graphics from people sending me artwork to process. And I've noticed lately that they come in with things grouped in odd ways, things that are, you know, on different parts of the screen that are completely unrelated are grouped together. And there's a function called clipping mask, which was designed to take a picture and clip it into a shape
Yes,
know,
sure.
So that you can eliminate the parts you don't want.
Uh-huh.
And the same thing is happening where things that are not related are clipping masks into things. So
what you're saying is you have an older file format of Illustrator
No, they're coming in from the new version. These are, you know, graphics coming from professionals who have the latest version. They're sending me the graphics to
And you don't have the latest version?
No, I have it.
Interesting. So they're sending you an Illustrator file with has a clipping mask or other layers, and when you get them, the layers have been kind of reshuffled as the clipping mask has been defined.
I don't think they're doing
it. Is this only one person you've seen this from,
no,
or multiple?
Everybody who has CS6.
I haven't heard of this problem, and I would assume if this problem was very rampant that I and Ben would know about it because we both do the Adobe Suite. I don't actually run 6, though, I don't think.
I've been running 6.
You're not seeing this problem, right?
I'm not doing Illustrator, though. I'm doing a lot more Photoshop.
Yeah, I do a lot more Photoshop, too.
Okay, yeah.
So the geek that's really the expert of Illustrator is not in today, Al. Mm. I think in this situation, have you done some Google searching to see if this is rampant?
Well, what I've done is I've taken files that I've gotten for people with this happening, yeah, and I've ungrouped everything and edited and done what I needed to do and then save it with, you know, thinking that it's going to stay the way I left it.
Of course.
With everything ungrouped. And when I reopen the file, everything is back in clipping masks and these weird groups again.
Okay, you definitely have a problem with your install. I mean, yeah. I'm assuming it's
That's
your machine. Because if you were to change it, then save it and reopen it, there's no transition from a different machine. So I think you've got some kind of problem in Illustrator of your install. And what I would do, because Illustrator is such a crucial app, is I would do an erasing of Illustrator completely from your entire Adobe Suite, completely from your computer, and reinstalling. And the question I have is, have you been doing upgrade installs?
No, this was a brand new package we just bought. I just started working.
And I hope you make money in that, because that's an expensive application.
Yeah.
Package.
Did you have any CS installed before? CS5, 5.5?
Yeah, CS5 was in.
Okay.
Before.
So the other thing you should do is definitely first, before you do anything else, just go and make sure you get all the Adobe updates to Illustrator. That's crucial. Are you on your Mac or Windows machine?
Windows.
Yeah, that might be why Ben and I aren't seeing this problem.
It might
be a problem for them.
The other thing I would say, just briefly, is Google how to remove CS5 and CS6 entirely. It'll tell you where every single file is. You can go and delete them manually. It's a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
But
and this is possible that you're having some kind, it's oddly, but it's possible you're having some kind of hard drive problem or some kind of caching problem, because this kind of the kind of changes you're talking about are kind of inconsistently strange. Could also be RAM. Your computer's RAM could have a problem in it, and your machine might not necessarily know, and this might be the only time it shows up. But we're running out of time. I'm curious about your problem. Please let me know how it goes.
Yeah, email us.
Okay.
Celebrating 40 years together, this is 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. My name's Lyle Troxell. Everything we do on GeekSpeak is available at geekspeak.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark by David Lawrence. And it's used with permission. We appreciate the Puppet Master's use of this. Today in the air with me was Ben Jaffe. Ben Jaffe's a freelance media guy and world traveler. Ben, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thank you, Lyle. It's been fun.
And, you know, answering the phones every week is Rick. And Rick is awesome. He's here all the time, behind the scenes, making the flow of the show work. The problems with the phones are almost always my fault, or Miles's, never his. And I just want to make sure to thank Rick.
Tried.
Yeah, you never try. If you tried, you'd totally miss it.
Of course.
Coming up next is Car Talk with Click and Clack. Thanks for listening.